Colton didn't know where to rest his eyes in the wait from now until when the food appeared. He sucked down the last of his Mountain Dew and wished there was a window so he could look outside at the sky or the desert. "Hey, Colton," said one of the crew, "you like the show?" Colton frowned into his empty glass. "Girls look kind of cold to me." Someone said, "Wanna go warm them up, Colton?" Everyone laughed. Colton stuffed a wad of chew into his lip, scratched the back of his neck. And then the waitress came back with the food. The crew started flirting with her while she put their plates down on the table, but she said nothing until she put Colton's plate in front of him, and he thanked her. "Now, boy," said the waitress, "if any of you had half the manners of Blue Eyes over here, I think you'd all get twice as lucky with the girls."
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Alexandra Fuller learned about the world of Wyoming oil field workers when researching an article for The New Yorker. That article turned into a book, a biography, and a lament when she learned about the death of a 25-year-old roughneck. Colton H. Bryant fell to his death off a drilling platform for lack of a $2,000 safety rail. Alexandra Fuller is best known for her 2002 memoir about growing up in a dysfunctional white farming family in Africa. It was called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Now Fuller lives in Wyoming, which she says reminds her of Africa in its beauty, harshness, and treatment by companies that, she says, do much in the way of environmental damage and show little in the way of compassion. This reading of The Legend of Colton H. Bryant was recorded in May 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thanks so much for coming out. I'm so nervous. The guy who was the roadie for Janis Joplin once told me that I was the loudest person he had ever heard, and it's made me so nervous that I tend to sort of whisper and creep now when I'm up here. So I hope you can hear me while I'm whispering and creeping nervously. Thank you so much for coming out. Politics and Prose is one of my absolute all-time favorite stores. It's almost the reason we write. You're sitting in somewhere like Wyoming, and you can often feel like you've fallen into the cultural black hole of Calcutta. I mean, after all, Dick Cheney is my neighbor, so that's what we have for independent reading. And so it is so refreshing to be here in his second home. I didn't start out to write a book about Colton H. Bryant. I started out to write a book about my opinions, because that felt good, you know. I'm a liberal, and I've got Dansko clogs, and the Republicans are doing this awful thing to the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, so I could wade right in onto the oil patch on my white horse of liberalism and point out how wrong and bad they were and how right and great I was, and be a great book. And I was sort of planning a Michael Pollan-type book, which would demonstrate, you know, the sausage of energy, that energy isn't free, and if you want to use energy, you might not want to look into the sausage factory. You know, and it's great because I'm very opinionated and I talk a lot. And so here was an opportunity for me to use both those great skills that I've been given. I've been married 16 years. And I think in that time, my husband's managed one complete sentence. And it was because I had been under anesthetic and I was having mouth surgery at the same time. And he said to me afterwards, you know, I think one or the other you probably could have overcome, but both finally silenced you. The reason I have this peculiar accent is that I'm from Southern Africa. So, you know, I grew up without freedom of speech. You know, Ian Smith wasn't keen on people who disagreed with what he was up to. Mugabe doesn't seem to be all that keen on people disagreeing with what he has going on. Once in Zambia, we elected a democratic government by the name of Chiluba, and for about 2 days, he said, let's have freedom of speech, and then the first newspapers rolled off the press, and he decided he did not like freedom of speech so much after all, so that got shut down. So when I came to the United States, where freedom of speech is this much touted thing, I thought, fantastic. I figured everyone, since you had freedom of speech, would be using it all the time, you know, like a combat sport. Like you would go out to dinner and people would start talking about gay marriage and abortion, and they would say nasty things about the president just because you could. And my husband said, just because you have freedom of speech doesn't mean it's necessary to use it 24/7. In fact, if you want to get invited out to dinner ever again, best you turn that down, or better even off. Off would be good. So, you know, here I am with all my opinions wanting to write about the oil patch and what's going so desperately wrong out there. The 2005 energy bill pretty much rolled back any environmental and human health laws that had been kept in place since the Nixon era to defend us from the worst impulses of our greed. So I was determined to write about that. And one of the things I wanted to write about was the lives of a roughneck. I'd spent a little bit of time on a rig. Actually, I'd spent a couple of hours and realized if I was there any longer, I'd probably end up dead. It's incredibly loud. That machinery works very, very fast. You're standing in something that feels like a battleship turned up on end. Weather is brutal. There is absolutely nowhere to hide from the elements. And so, you know, during the course of my research for a magazine piece about the environmental consequences of drilling, four obituaries came across the newspapers that I was looking at. And that's four obituaries from men who had fallen off rigs because of rig failure, just on the one tiny oil patch I was looking at, let alone the rest of Wyoming, let alone the rest of the Rocky Mountain West, let alone Alaska. And I mean, an oil patch is as big as a few city blocks. It's not very big. You can easily drive across an oil patch in an hour or two. And I thought, you know, one death, one massive rig failure seems, you know, a little upsetting. Two seems, you know, a little careless. Three, you're thinking, okay. And it was the same company. All these men were drilling for Ultra Petroleum. By the third one, wouldn't you think, well, oh God, we've had three rig failures. Maybe we should check up on this. So when the fourth rig failure happened, unlike the rest of the obituaries, which tend to be sort of a column in the left-hand side of the paper, and then there's usually a big article about what the latest rogue wolf has done. People in Wyoming tend to believe about wolves the way the rest of the world believes in the devil. You know, by the time it came to that fourth rig death, what really struck me and stopped me in my tracks was his obituary read different than anything that I'd seen before. For one thing, he was 25 years old. He had a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old. He had this name, Colton H. Bryant. There was something kind of poetic about that. And the obituary said he was a romantic person and a loving husband and father. He loved to tease. He was never late. And there was nothing he wouldn't try to do. And there was something in that he was never late that I thought, I wonder who this man was. So sort of shaking and trembling, I did that Google who or how, you know, that search on the computer. And I found who his father was and called up. Now, his father's a roughneck, and he works on the rigs 2 weeks and is only home 2 weeks. He never picks up the telephone. In my experience, when the phone rings in Bill Bryant's home, if he isn't feeding the horses, he will find an excuse to go and feed the horses. He hates talking on the phone. But for some reason, he picked up the phone, and I said, you know, I think I'm writing a story about energy, and I've come across a story about your son, and I wonder if I could speak to you. And he said, sure. And I said, where do you live? And he said, Southwest Wyoming. And I said, okay, how long do you think it'll take me to get there from Jackson? He said, about 4 hours. I said, well, how will I find you? And he said, I drive a cherry red pickup. Only in Wyoming. So I hopped in my car and drove sort of down to Southwest Wyoming. And sure enough, at the appointed time, there is a cherry red pickup sort of belting down this dirt road. And I've never felt so self-conscious about driving a German-made station wagon with the bumper sticker that said, men who change diapers change the world. But along comes this cowboy, and he kind of looks out the window, and he's wearing his big black cowboy hat, and he's got these eyes that just look right through you. The thing I found out about real cowboys is they aren't really so much interested in what you're saying. They really aren't taking that in much at all. They're much more interested in what your intentions are, and they just looking straight through. Felt like at my soul. You've never wished you'd done your laundry so badly as right then. So I gradually got to know Colton H. Bryant through interviewing his family, his best friend, who lives opposite the rig. He lives over the road from the rig where Colton fell. His best friend's name's Jake. And what started to happen in the course of listening so hard for Colton H. Bryant, I might have been a fan of exercising freedom of speech, but Bill Bryant was a fan of that other great tradition, which is the freedom to remain silent. And so I found myself asking him questions and realizing that sometimes the answer was simply the wind. He'd sometimes stick a wad of tobacco in his lip and just spit if he was particularly disgusted with the question. And that said everything I needed to know. And trying to figure out how to write that silence into a book. How do you write that kind of deep, stoical silence into dialogue? Might explain why this is a very short book. If you're mildly constipated, you can read it in one sitting. And my books are getting shorter and shorter. I mean, next I'll be writing a pamphlet if I live in Wyoming any longer. But the great, great South African poet, he's an Afrikaans poet called Breyten Breytenbach. Only an Afrikaner would give their child a name like that. But he was anti-apartheid, which you can imagine was massively unpopular with the other white Afrikaners. So they slammed him in solitary confinement, because the last thing you want is some disagreeing Afrikaner spreading ideas like apartheid's a bad idea to everyone else. And he, in an interview I heard him give, he talked about how in solitary confinement, it is human nature to exchange ideas. That's why we are storytellers and story told, and you have stories for me. And we need that exchange of ideas. Otherwise, there is nothing separating us really from the rest of the world, and there is nothing to put us in place and time. And Breyten Breytenbach, you can't talk in solitary confinement because no one can hear you. So the men would sing to each other, and they would start a song, and then gradually by the end of the night, the whole prison would be singing. Which, you know, imagine, pissed off the guards, no end, because the last thing you want to, you know, happy, well-adjusted prisoners communicating with one another. But Breyten Breytenbach talks about how the night before a man was executed, only that man would sing. And although none of the other prisoners could see that man, Breytenbach talks about how he could feel the quality of listening change in the room. He could feel people straining to hear every last word that that person said, the last song of the man who was going to be executed. And as I tried to get to the core of who Colton H. Bryant was, I feel as if that's what I was doing. I was listening for Colton's last song. He was a very simple boy in many, many ways. The furthest he ever drove was Arizona. He didn't really have a great understanding of the rest of the world. In other ways, he was sophisticated beyond, you know, beyond the dreams of those of us who sort of go to yoga and shrinks and I don't know what else. I did a reading in Southwest Wyoming for his family, and I talked about how nerve-wracking it is to write a book. And I could see Bill Bryant, Colton's father, looking at me like, well, how could that be more nerve-wracking than, for example, getting on a bucking bull? So I was trying to sort of, I said, well, you know, I had to go and see a shrink. And he was looking blankly. And I realized, well, okay, a shrink is someone you have to go to if you don't know what to do with your feelings. And he still looked kind of blank. And I said, okay, feelings are what you have if you're not a cowboy from Southwest Wyoming. And Colton did have feelings, though, and he always told everyone he knew he was going to die by the time he was 25. He was very forgiving, which is astonishing, extremely expansive in his acceptance and non-judgment of people in a way that blew me away as I sort of gradually got to know him. So this is Colton in a strip club. Here he is working on a oil rig, and all the boys decide it's hot and they're bored and they've had enough of shooting stop signs, so they're going to go to a strip club. The boys ducked into the relieving air-conditioned chill of the dark lounge and showed their driver's licenses to the bouncer. Oh, and by the way, try and get a man in Wyoming to talk to you about anything. It's not going to work. Try to get a man in Wyoming to talk to you about going to a strip club. It's so not going to work. So, for I'd phone up Bill Bryant and I would say, so did you guys ever do a cattle drive? You know, because Colton trained his own Mustang off the desert.
Yep.
So what do you do on a cattle drive? Move cows? Okay. Do you have anything more you'd want to say about that? Nope. Okay, good. So I'd have to phone up my cowboy friend and say, you guys moving cows anytime soon?
Yep.
Can I move cows with you?
Yep.
But a cowboy will never give you a direct instruction. When I first met Bill Bryant and asked if I could go back and interview him and his wife, And I said, so, you know, should we go back to your house? And yeah. I said, well, so how do I get there? Should I follow you? Long silence. Well, he said, that would be one way. And I realized that cowboy never gives you a direct instruction because they figure the crappy weather or, you know, a rank horse is going to take care of it. So if you're so stupid you can't figure out yourself, they're not going to waste the breath telling you what to do. You know, I go move cows with this guy, this rancher. No one told me, whatever you do, do not arrive to move cows with an Arabian mare. So at the end, there's some knowing giggles here. I get to the end of this cattle drive in which I'm barely alive. The horses have never behaved so badly. We just about lost a herd of steers. And I said to my friend, the rancher, hey, you know, I'm the only one on a mare. And he went, yep. So I was trying to ask the guy, so what's it like? What's the Astro Lounge strip club like? I don't know. So there was some research that had to go into this. The music was loud and repetitive, like it was trying to drown out thought. They found a quiet table near the back, and everyone ordered a beer except Colton, who said he'd have a Mountain Dew, please. Colton didn't drink, didn't swear, was nice to women. He's the cowboy that we all hear about. The waitress was pretty in a desperate, worn-out sort of way, with hair so bleached it had deconstructed into a mild fizz around her face and sad green eyes. But she had strong, child-bearing arms and long, muscled legs. Her voice was husky with smoking. She asked if anyone wanted to have anything to eat, and people placed their orders. And Colton asked for a double cheeseburger with fries and extra ketchup, please. Colton had a T-shirt that said, I put ketchup on my ketchup. When I was writing about him, and I did that trick that all writers do when they come up against a dry spell and they really don't know what else to say next, I did a Google search of everything I knew about Colton. So I put ketchup and guns and hunt and shoot and fishing and pickup trucks. You love pickup trucks. And I pressed enter. And the first thing that popped up was, you might be a redneck if. And he looked up at the waitress in that way he had, and she sucked in her breath with those eyes looking through her, and she plain couldn't help herself. I guess, the one thing that came up over and over again about Colton was these eyes that just look straight through you. And until I met both sets of grandparents at the reading I did on Friday, I didn't really know what they were talking about. As Colton lay dying on life support after he fell off the rigs for want of a couple of rails, which would have cost $2,000, for which the drilling company was fined $7,031, and the family was compensated nothing. As he lay there dying, and they decided they needed to pull the plug on him. His younger sister told me that she said, before we do that, I just need to open his eyelids one last time. I'm never going to see eyes that blue again. And there were so many moments about Colton, but his eyes must have been something. They certainly stopped traffic. So those eyes looking through her, and she plain couldn't help herself. She leaned right over him. And anything else for you, blue eyes? She asked. Colton looked down quickly and said, no, thank you, ma'am. I hate that I can't do a Rocky Mountain English accent, but I can hear it, but I can't say it. And it's frustrating for me. If you put the Queen of England and the Bryant family in the same room, you would need a translator, because it ain't the same language. When Jake, Colton's best friend, answers the phone, I get, hello. And I laugh for 5 minutes before I can carry on with the conversation. So poetic. Colton looked down quickly and said, no, thank you, ma'am. Up on the stage, two women were thrusting their bits and pieces at the audience and at one another, and their underwear looked unequal to the task. Colton didn't know where to rest his eyes and the wait from now until when the food appeared. He sucked down the last of his Mountain Dew and wished there was a window so he could look outside at the sky or the desert. Hey, Colton, said one of the crew, you like the show? Colton frowned into his empty glass. Girls look kind of cold to me. Someone said, want to go warm them up, Colton? Everyone laughed. Colton stuffed a wad of chew into his lip and scratched the back of his neck. And then the waitress came back with the food. The crew started flirting with her while she put their plates down on the table, but she said nothing until she put Colton's plate in front of him, and he thanked her. Now, boys, said the waitress, if any of you had half the manners of blue eyes over here, I think you'd all get twice as lucky with the girls. The boys hooted with laughter. The waitress kissed Colton on the top of the head. I could just take you home and eat you, she said. Wee-haw, the boys screamed. Will that be all? Asked the waitress, resting a hip so close to Colton that he could smell her confusing mixture of scents, cigarettes and perfume, and something like the leftover smell of a sweat-stained horse. What else you got? One of the boys shouted. Nothing for you, said the waitress, but she rested her hand on Colton's shoulder for a moment longer. Then she laughed a smoky laugh and walked quickly away to another table. Wee-haw, the boy screamed again. Holy crap, said Colton, frowning at his double cheeseburger. I sure hope my mum never finds out about this. The more I got to know Colton, I think that in the last few years with this administration and... I can hardly even say those words... I've built up a self-protective sort of armor of cynicism. There seemed no other way to survive. get snarky and a bit sort of, I don't know, ironic and cynical, and that we would all exist that way until 2008. In fact, I was so snarky that I actually outdid myself in Aspen, Colorado last year, right when the Attorney General scandal was happening. And because I'm from Southern Africa, I always get the question from someone. It doesn't matter what I'm talking about. Someone always has to ask me what I think of Mugabe. So I was prepared for this great moment. So I said, oh, what do I think of Mugabe? I said, well, let's see. Let's go through what he's stolen an election. He started an illegal war, which bankrupted his country. Inflation's gone through the roof. He fires anyone who disagrees with him. He hires his ineffective cronies. And then I said, oh, wait, that's George W. Bush's list. Where's Mugabe's list? And outraged, 10 people got up, marched out furiously. But what I found, talking about Colton to the people who loved him, that snarky, ironic, self-protective thing that I was doing was not real. It wasn't getting through to Colton. And I wasn't able to really understand who Colton was as long as I was protecting myself from who he was or protecting myself from feeling the world and my sort of snarky self-righteousness. And the more I stayed with Colton's story, the more extraordinary the story about him got. His best friend heard the helicopter flying in to pick up Colton the night that Colton fell off the rig. When you hear a helicopter in Wyoming, it's like hearing a helicopter in Africa. It's almost never a good thing. In Wyoming, it usually means the vice president's arrived or there's been a horrible accident. And in this case, it was Colton falling off the rig. His friend drove hell for leather down to Salt Lake City to be by his friend's side and was there when they pulled the plug on Colton. And Colton's heart kept going for 20 minutes. And the way Jake tells it, well, he had a big heart to begin with, the most forgiving person. So he's lost his best friend. He's on his way home. First thing he had to do was stop at the pawn shop and retrieve all of Colton's stuff because Colton treated the pawn shop the way the rest of us treat an ATM machine. So he had to get out Colton's saddle and boots and bridle and CD collection. And he got home, to his cabin. He spent the night. He woke up on the morning of the 16th of February, and there was a sundog. It was February 16th, so it's snowy in Wyoming, and there is this sundog, which is a pillar of rainbow, right over the rig where Colton fell. And the more I couldn't deny this stuff, the more I couldn't deny that we were all, somehow, I was beginning to feel Colton's soul. I'd never meet him, but I was beginning to feel his soul. So I went to the only place I knew what to do that with, which was the church, creepily enough, because I didn't really believe in God. So I went to the Episcopalian church because I figure they're less likely to mention God too much. And I sat there hostile with my arms crossed in the back pew, kind of glaring at the priest for a number of months, actually. And what is this with the eating of the flesh and the drinking of the blood stuff? I mean, as a kid, it kind of creeped me out. As an adult, it totally weirded me out. But, the whole reason I came here was to get rid of my snarky, self-protective, ironic, liberal prejudices. So I'm going to have to go up there and get humble. So I went up to the altar, and I got down on my knees to receive communion. And I looked sort of three people down, and is my arch enemy. It's the guy who's so pro-drilling, Dick Cheney's best friend, the guy who thinks that the arguments we have. Here, his son and my son play hockey, and at hockey matches, we have to be separated. That's how bad it is. I'm on my knees, ready to receive the bread and the wine, and I think that is the gift of Colton H. Bryant. There is no way I could have known this boy, a redneck, roughneck from southwest Wyoming, who loved all he wanted. His biggest achievement in life would have been to drive a F-350 white Ford pick-em-up truck. So they buried him with toy pick-em-up trucks in his pockets. But in every other way, I'd connected with him. And the lesson of Colton H. Bryant is we do all eat from the same loaf and we do all drink from the same cup. We do have to use the same energy and breathe the same air. And unless we're prepared to do that together, I think we're lost. That was a great and humbling lesson and a great gift from a boy who maybe otherwise would have gone left unnoticed. So, on that note, thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I was wondering if the oil companies found out what you were doing and what their reactions were like.
Not yet. I imagine they're not going to be exceedingly thrilled. Listen, Wyoming in general is a very different, difficult culture to be a loudmouth liberal in. I'm surprised I have not been found head stuffed down a badger hole yet. They do not tolerate outspoken women. I don't know if anyone was listening to Diane Rehm's show today and someone phoned in who was just like the people from Wyoming and kept referring to me as that woman. And I was like, man, I feel like I'm just shut my eyes and I could be back in Wyoming. I did an op-ed piece actually in the New York Times about how if you disagree with the oil companies, because their taxes fund so the university, the, you know, pretty much everything, if you're not in lockstep with them, then, you know, you'll get your funding pulled. And for me, that's a violation of freedom of speech. Okay, so that got published on Sunday. Monday morning, 8:30 in the morning, a state senator from Cheyenne felt free to call me at home and tell me that what I was doing was not exercising freedom of speech. I was shouting fire in a crowded playhouse. And then he said very slowly, do you understand the difference? And I said, yes, I do. I am from Zambia and Zimbabwe. And that is very clear to me. And I said, and by the way, even though it's very early and I'm at home, I have had my first cup of tea and I have a pencil and I'm a writer and you're a public figure, so everything you're saying is being taken down. Do you wish to restate what you just said? The power of the pen. And this guy has this huge, big oil rig on his belt buckle and he stands up at meetings and you just want to say, is that a belt buckle or are you pleased to see me? The other line I'm dying to use when he comes to harass me is, hey, you got rails on that rig? Because rails save lives. So I don't know, some loudmouth like me, I imagine I'm going to get into a fair amount of trouble, don't you? I do. Every time I go down the oil patch now, I tell someone where I'm going, when I'm expected to be back, and if I don't, you know, I want a long, exuberant funeral.
I just have two short questions. One, what possessed you to go to Wyoming? And two, how is Bill Bryant doing since he still works in the business, and everybody's read this book?
I love possessed me. I fell in love with a man from Wyoming. You got to watch out for those cowboy boots, man. Bill Bryant, when I was researching this book, got fired for a 10-gallon fuel discrepancy. He was fired on the spot. He's been working for the same drilling company for 30 years. Some kid from Houston said, hey, you didn't write this down right, you're fired on the spot. So, Bill has only ever, he, other than riding Saddle Bronx, and he's getting a little old for that, he has no other choice other than to work on the rig. So he went to Cheyenne and he resubmitted himself for blood and urine tests. And they put him to work drilling about a quarter of a mile as the crow flies from where his son fell. It was a long 4 months for Bill Bryant. He finally got work closer to home. I cannot imagine what this book was for him to read. He's never read another book. He's read one book in his life, and that is The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. His mother read it, and she felt like the initial way that I'd written the death scene was I'd glossed over it too much, and she said, no, I need you to tell people that I had to hold onto my son's hand and pray to God for the strength to see him out of this world. So I gave her that. She also said, I don't care if they say that word on the rigs. I don't want that word in this book about my son. So the poetic license of that is that my roughnecks say freaking. Bill Bryant read the book. He was out on the rigs, and it, you know, I gave it to him. And some days later, I called him up and said, you got a chance to read it while I was drilling? And give me a couple of days. So I called back in a couple of days, and I said, well, did you read it? Just about to throw up, you know. And he goes, well, I couldn't sleep last night, so I got up at about 2 in the morning, and I got her done. And I said, what did you think? And he said, you did okay. So I don't really give a damn what the New York Times book review says. Bill Bryant says I did okay. And, you know, in Evanston, doing this reading, Bill Bryant, just, man, he looks right through you. You're like, man, I wish I'd done my laundry. I've done emptied the dishwasher. It's like everything you haven't done, he knows, and everything you have done. And but he didn't say anything. I mean, at the very end, I got a little half smile, and then I was signing books, and I had roughnecks coming up, and they were all, you know, being a bit, well, we came here to give you a hard time, but I don't know, it sounds like maybe this book's okay, even though you got that funny accent. Hope you got the accent right in the book, man. And Bill Bryant just came and sat there with me. And that was about the biggest act of presence. I don't believe I've ever felt so supported in my life. So I hope to God that the oil companies read this book before they jump all over the assumption that he ever said anything bad about them. That was my interpretation. He is one of the most stoical men I know. So I really hope they don't go. I mean, if they go after anyone, go after the loudmouth. I mean, what are they going to do, take my pencil away? One last question, I think. Yeah.
Well, you said that you wrote the book, that it came out of you. You wrote it for yourself. And I'm wondering, with respect to affecting change for the things about which you're concerned, whether you have a sense that your voice and this book constitute a story that will be heard by two particular constituencies. I think it's likely to be heard by the sort of people amongst whom you find yourself today. But the perhaps non-now adaptively laconic, stoic cowboys who are having to earn a living doing what you describe them doing, as well as the people in charge of the oil companies.
I don't think the CEOs of oil companies read books no matter what, really, pretty much, unless it's Manage Your Finances. The 4-Hour Work Week, I bet they read that one. To begin with, I did write this book with my voice all over it. I had written it as a traditional, you know, nonfiction with me doing the interviews, and then I said, and then I saw. And then what I realized, though, was that who the hell wants to hear me? I'm sick of hearing me. Everyone I know is sick of hearing me. But no one's ever heard Colton H. Bryant. And Colton would never have had a way to write his own story. And so me shutting up, which was a massive development, you know, truly, gave Colton a voice. And it is so much more powerful than anything I could have done. Listen, man, the Roughnecks at that thing in Evanston the book sold out. The Roughnecks were buying it, and they said, we're going to pass this on. There isn't that experience that's been written from what felt like the inside out. I felt absolutely haunted by Colton. This wasn't me. I started out, I think, wanting to write for myself. I ended up writing entirely for Colton. So thank you for that question. Thank you so much for coming out. It was great.
Thanks for listening to Book Tour. For more talks like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.